talking a little bit about meditation, and then there'll be a little time for questions and answers. Then we'll do a little practice of meditation and more little talk and questions and answers. We're doing this all day. We will take a break between 12 and 1 o'clock and carry on for this afternoon until about 4 o'clock. Those of you who have to go early, don't have to court hold or anything. Please, when you need to go, you can just slip out quietly. So we'll keep it nice and free and easy, which is supposed to be really the Buddhist tradition. Gentleness and kindness and openness. But the meditation is, I'm very happy to teach meditation because having learned meditation myself about 40 years ago, and also knowing just how wonderful it is for a person's life, and having taught it for the last 25 years or more, it's a great thing to be able to teach. It has huge benefits to human beings. It lowers your cholesterol, lowers your blood pressure, increases the size of your brain. It reduces all the stress levels. This has such a good press from research which has been done that here in Thailand and also in countries like Europe, United States and Australia, it's so well known to help you that in California, where there is no public health system, where everybody has to get medical insurance, if you can get a signed declaration from someone like a monk, which proves that you do practice meditation regularly, you get a huge reduction on the amount of money you have to pay for healthcare. So it even saves you money. And the reason is, it's because the evidence is there. It is good for your health. And in my hometown of Perth, that little book which we're giving out, The Basic Method of the Meditation, the green one there, that is in many doctors' surgeries throughout Perth. And these are doctors who aren't Buddhists, Christians, Muslims, I don't know, but they have that book there because they know that meditation does help reduce the causes of much sickness. And that's why they have it in their surgeries, just patients can pick it up for free. However, if we have more of those books in Perth, I'll probably be putting the doctors out of business. People won't get sick. Because a lot of sick is just because you're stressed out. And meditation is a great way of overcoming that stress. So first of all, remember what the goal of meditation is. To be relaxed. In the West I say, relax to the max. In other words, really let go and allow the body and the mind to become still. Because the more you control your body and mind, the stiffer it is, the further you go away from meditation. Meditation is calm, peace, stillness, softness, gentleness. And if you understand what meditation is, just the feeling of meditation, then you will never get this terrible stress which people have in their daily lives. This is the time of Vaisak in Thailand. And one of the stories from the history of the Buddha was when, before he sat under that Bodhi tree to become enlightened, he took his alms bowl and he floated it in the river Nirmala and made a determination that if I have the qualities to become an enlightened one, may my bowl flow against the current. May it go upstream instead of downstream. And many of you have heard that story before. You know, it actually went upstream against the current. But not only was that an omen, it was also an indication of how meditation and enlightenment happens. You go against the stream. And the stream which I'm talking about now is the stream which always goes on to the next thing, always goes out from where you are, always wants something new, something different, something else. That's what we call craving. That's what we call restlessness. That's what makes you think and worry and be concerned. And here we're going in the opposite direction. Instead of going outwards, we go inwards. Into the body, into the moment, into the silence, and into the breath. Always going inwards, 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 inwards. So first of all, to be able to go into the body, you have to get your body reasonably comfortable. Now you see all these people here sitting on the floor. They are not as smart as all the people sitting in the chairs. Because it's much more comfortable sitting in a chair. However, people think if they sit cross-legged, especially in full lotus with a straight back, they're going to get enlightened quicker. Well, the point of the matter is, your posture, the way you have your body, it does not matter. In my first year as a monk, I was in with Ajahn Chah in Ubon. And in that time that I got typhus fever, like many of the other monks did in that forest monastery, and got sent into the monk's ward of Ubon Hospital. It must have been about 1974 or 75. And at that time, it was a very backward hospital. I had typhus fever, same symptoms as typhoid. And when you went in there, you feel so weak with a heavy fever. And so they put me in this the monk's ward, maybe about a dozen beds. And just after 6 o'clock, they had a nurse on the station there, left. By about 7 o'clock, the replacement nurse hadn't come. And I asked the monk in the next bed to me, "When is the night nurse going to come?" And he said, "Night nurse? There is no night nurse. If anything happens to you in the middle of the night, that's just bad karma." And I was from the West. I wanted a nurse to be there. But even worse than that, for 12 hours, whatever happened to us, there's no way of calling a doctor, calling a nurse or anything. So it was a very poor hospital in those days. But even worse than that, because they didn't know what the fever was at the time, all they could do is inject a cocktail of antibiotics twice a day into your backside. Now those were the days before disposable needles. Those were the days when the needles were recycled. I remember at that time Thailand was a poor country. So whatever needles they had were used here in Bangkok first of all, before being sent up to the provinces. The East and the North East is supposed to be the tough country, the backwaters of Thailand. So they'd send all the disused needles up there to save money. And they'd use them on the ordinary patients first of all, and last of all the monks got them because we were supposed to be the tough guys. And I've never felt such a blunt needle. Twice a day, this nurse came into the ward. I don't know if you've been up country and seen the water buffaloes, but that's what the nurse reminded me of. She was so strong, like a quai. She had to be strong, because she didn't inject you, they stabbed you. And my bottom was so sore after 3 or 4 days, it was like going to the principal of the school to get punished. Oh, I hated that. But in the middle of that time, because I was a monk and I'd learned meditation, I recall very clearly one day I felt so weak, so tired, and just so dispirited because, not only was I very weak and in pain and my bottom was so sore, I decided, why don't you meditate? You're a monk. So I decided to meditate in the way which I'm going to tell you now. And I got into this very, very deep meditation. It's so peaceful, so beautiful, so happy. And the reason I tell this story is when I came out afterwards, I looked at the way I was, not sitting, laying on the bed. A leg was one way, another leg was somewhere else, the arms were all over the place. It was a posture which I've never seen in any meditation book. All that taught me was, the way you have your body, it does not matter. I know sometimes that some teachers, some monks or nuns say you've got to put your hands in the lap, you know, the right hand over the left hand, or you've got to put your hands on your knees, or you've got to put your hands somewhere, and you've got to sit with a straight back and the right foot of the left foot, or whatever it is. That's a lot of rubbish. Don't worry about that. What's more important is your body feels comfortable, which is why in our modern world, sitting on a chair, or like the very smart lady in the corner there, you've got the best position there. In a nice corner there, you can actually lean this way and lean that way. That is the first class seat. Because you can get reasonably comfortable. Because otherwise, you have to worry about how your body is sitting. So the first thing in meditation, get a comfortable position. You know, on Waisak, where did the Buddha sit before he became enlightened? Under the Bodhi tree. Have you ever seen a Bodhi tree and tried to sit on the roots of a Bodhi tree? They're all knobbly. So the Buddha would not just actually sit on the Bodhi tree. He got some grass, first of all, to make himself a big, fat cushion. Now, even the Buddha did that. So don't try and outsmart the Buddha by sitting without cushions. Be comfortable. It's called the middle way. But the only important part of your posture, this is the only way you hold your body, which is important, is this. Make sure the corners are turned up. Smile, for goodness sake, when you meditate. Because people put their legs this way, that way, the back straight, the hands this way. That is not important, but this is important. Because if you're gritting your teeth, you're never going to get anywhere in meditation. Even a horizontal mouth is not good enough. If you turn the corners up, as every psychologist knows, if you can't make a smile, fake it. Imagine someone's taking your photograph. And then if you smile, straight away, psychologically, the mind is looking for happiness. It's relaxing, it's having fun. It's sunuk. Well, you know what it's like in Thailand. If it's not sunuk, it's not worth doing. So if meditation is not sunuk, you won't like to do it again. So let's make this a sunuk meditation day. So when it's fun, you turn the corners up in the mouth. Then you'll find the mind will engage in the whole process of meditation. So you get the body comfortable. If during the meditation that your body is uncomfortable, you know, your legs are hurting or whatever, move them. Don't go around like trying to be a tough guy or a tough girl. I'm going to just fight through pain. I'm going to just sit here. Or like the Buddha once said, I am going to sit here even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust. I'm not going to move from this place until I become enlightened. You know, I did that once. My very first Waisak was at my first year at Cambridge University. I had a Buddhist club there. We invited a monk up from London. We had this Waisak day. Oh, I was so inspired. And when I heard that story of the Buddha's enlightenment, sitting down there and making that resolution, no, my bones turn to dust, though my blood dries up, I won't move from my seat until I become enlightened. You know, when I heard that, I thought, well, you know, if the Buddha can do it, why not me? So I went back to my room. I'd only ever meditated for about 20 minutes max. Then I said, you know, I was in a rush to get enlightened because I had other things to do in my life. I want to get that over and done with quickly. So I sat down there on my seat and said, if my blood dries up, my bones turn to dust, I'm not going to move from my three cushions until I become fully enlightened. I know I lasted about half an hour. I broke my record by about 10 minutes. But after half an hour, you know, I wasn't enlightened. I was in enormous pain. And when I opened my eyes, my blood hadn't dried up yet. Not my bones turned to dust. That's not the way to do it. So don't be stupid like that and try and outdo the Buddha. You have to be smart. Use wisdom rather than willpower. And to be able to use that wisdom instead of willpower, you sit down comfortably. And if your body hurts, without opening the eyes, just gently move the body. Just move the legs, or just move the body, whatever it is, or scratch as mindfully as you can, as carefully as you can, without making any noise, and then go back to your meditation afterwards. You will find that by doing such, the obstacle of physical discomfort will be overcome. Because you've moved, you have disturbed the process of stillness, but you've disturbed it only slightly. It's like pressing the pause button on a movie. You're just pausing it, and then you go back a few frames before you repeat the movie. So what happens when you're meditating? If you move, you just pause for a little while, you go back only slightly, but you soon make up that lost ground within a few seconds. And that way your meditation proceeds much deeper, much better. So don't be afraid of moving. Even coughing. If you need to cough, please do it straight away. Otherwise, what happens? It's like a volcano. The pressure builds up and builds up and builds up, and when you do cough, you spray everybody in about 3 feet around you. And everybody hears it. It's best to cough quickly, get it over and done with, and then carry on meditating. So don't control. So that's with the bodily posture, and always keep the smile going. Remember that out of compassion for me, I'm sitting up here and I've got to look at you, and if you look so miserable, oh, that really makes me upset. So keep the smile going. It's actually important. And then once the body's nice and comfortable, you leave it alone. You've gone into the body, now you've got to go into the center of time. In other words, what we call the present moment. There's a nice story about this forest monk up in the northeast somewhere who was teaching meditation to a group of people like you on the one prayer, on the monk's day, the Sabbath day. And because on those days in those monasteries, lots of people come to bring food. And because it was a forest monastery, there was a monkey from the forest who was hanging about to see if he could get some bananas or mangoes, see whatever was there, because there's lots of food around, and so the monkey could steal something. But before they had the food ready, the monk was like me, sitting on a seat giving a sermon about meditation. And he was talking about the monkey mind. Have you heard the monkey mind before? A monkey mind is a mind which just goes all over the place. Just like a monkey on a tree, it swings from branch to branch to branch to branch, and it's never still. Because monkeys in the wild are always moving, swinging backwards and forwards. And this monk was saying that if you want to do good meditation, you have to get rid of the monkey mind. The monkey mind is a bad mind. It's an obstacle. It's a difficulty for you. The trouble was, when the monkey heard this, he got quite upset. What's wrong with a monkey mind? He said, this is defamation. This is libel. What did these human beings think they're so good for? What's wrong with a monkey mind? And he got so upset, he said, I'm not standing for this. Being scolded, being defamed by these monks. Nothing wrong with a monkey mind. I demand respect for the monkey mind, said the monkey. And he swung back into the forest to where his troop of monkeys was and complained to the leader. And all the other monkeys heard that and they were incensed. Why are you criticizing monkeys? It's wrong for human beings to criticize monkeys. They don't understand the nature of monkeys. They can't do this. We're not standing for this. And they started to protest and jump up and down complaining about being defamed by the human beings for having a monkey mind. And the leader said, seeing all the monkeys getting so upset and jumping down, he said, see, that's what the human beings say is a monkey mind. That is the monkey mind, jumping up and down and protesting and arguing like that. And all the monkeys agreed, yeah, we can understand why that monk said a monkey mind is bad. And they got very embarrassed. And then they thought, it is very awful having a monkey mind, never being still, never being peaceful. But how can we stop that? How can we get rid of our own monkey minds and be peaceful like those monks sitting in the forest monasteries? And the head monkey said, well, I've seen what the human beings do. They meditate to overcome the monkey minds. Why don't we do that, said the other monkeys. Okay, said the head monkeys, I will teach you. So all the monkeys, they all gathered together, just like you are now. And the head monkey was sitting on the seat in front of the microphone, and he was saying, sit down, put your right paw over your left paw. You monkeys, keep the back straight. Close your eyes and watch your breath go in and out. And there was about 100, how many people here? 200? It's about 200 monkeys were sitting down right paw over the left paw, watching their breath go in and out. And after only about 2 or 3 minutes, one of the monkeys put their hand up. Excuse me, said the monkey. Excuse me. And they all opened their eyes. What do you want? He said, don't you remember that we had planned to go to the banana plantation to rob it for lunch? Why don't we do that first? You know, get it out of the way. Then we can stop thinking about it. And once we've robbed the banana plantation, then we can meditate. And all the monkeys said, yeah, great idea. Let's get this out of the way first of all, and then we can meditate. So they all got up, they swung through the trees, and they got to the banana plantation, and they stole lots and lots of bananas. And they brought them back to the forest, put them in a heap. They wouldn't eat it yet, because it wasn't lunchtime. They just, you know, got it prepared. And then they all went back to their seats. No, right paw over the left paw, back straight, watching their breath. After 5 minutes, one of the monkeys put their hand up. Excuse me. Now I've been thinking, said that monkey. Now in about 40 minutes or so, we're going to have our lunch. Before we eat those bananas, you know, we've got to peel them first. Why don't we peel them first of all? We won't eat them, just peel them. And then we can meditate. Great idea, said the monkeys. So they peeled all the bananas and left all these bananas in a heap. Then they went back to their seats, right paw of the left paw, back straight, and started to meditate again. After 5 minutes, the monkey put his hand up. Excuse me, said monkey. I've been thinking, before we eat those bananas, we have to put them in our mouth first of all. Why don't we put them in our mouth? We won't eat them, we just put them in our mouth to get it ready. Then as soon as the meditation's over, we can eat it quickly. Great idea, said all the monkeys. So they all got a banana each and put it in the mouth. Some monkeys got two, one got three. You know how greedy some people are. And they put them in their mouth, and they closed it. Didn't eat it yet. Put them in their mouth, right paw over the left paw, back straight. And of course, once you've got bananas in your mouth, you can't help yourself, especially when you realize all the other monkeys got their eyes closed. And the monkeys ate all those bananas. And once they finished eating the bananas, meditation time was over, so they went away. So they never meditated at all. Now that's what the monkey mind is. Getting everything out of the way, and then I will meditate. And if you're someone like that, you will never meditate at all. That's what we call monkey mind. So don't be monkey meditators. Doesn't matter what's in front of you. You know, what time is lunch? 2 hours to go to lunch. Oh, now an hour and a half. Why don't you just, you know, get it all prepared first of all? Why don't you just put it on the plate, put it in front of you first of all, but you won't eat it yet. That's when we plan for the future. That's what we mean by a monkey mind. Always running around. So, by going into the center of time, everything which is in front of us, we don't concern ourselves about. Everything which we've done in the past, we let go of. So we're only left with what we call the now, the present moment. We're going into the center of time. Now that's a very crucial part of meditation, to get what we call present moment awareness. Just being here now. I don't know where you've come from. I don't know where you're going. Who cares? You're here now. I don't care what's happened to you in the past. all the problems and difficulties and pain and being cheated and not being looked after and not being cared for and having problems and troubles, that's gone. That's what we call dead stuff. So why be concerned about things which have already gone, which you can't change? Why can't we let go of that past? A lot of the time when we do remember the past, what type of past do you always remember? You remember what went wrong, don't you? All the difficulties and problems which you had. Ajahn Chah, one of Ajahn Chah's famous stories, is the story of the two chicken farmers. I'm going to use the S-H-I-T word again to make sure this is a story you'll always remember. In the Northeast, as I said last night, they use the word key, key, key. Two chicken farmers. First chicken farmer goes into the shed in the early morning to collect the produce from the night before. He takes the basket into the shed and he fills the basket with chicken shit, and he leaves the eggs in the barn to rot. That's a very stupid chicken farmer. This story was actually published in the Guardian newspaper about last month in Manchester in England. So if it passed their censors, I don't see why it can't pass the censors here. So he filled his basket with chicken shit and left the eggs to rot. Chicken farmer number two went into the shed. He left the chicken shit to rot, which is what you're supposed to do, and collected only the eggs and brought the eggs back into the house, cooked an omelette for all his family, and sold the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That is a smart chicken farmer. Now, when Ajahn Chah told that story, the meaning was this. When you collect the produce of your past, when you start to remember what happened to you so far this week, what do you collect? The eggs or the shit? What type of chicken farmer are you? It's crazy, isn't it? Why do we always collect the things which went wrong and never collect the nice memories? We leave the nice memories in the past to rot instead of leaving the shit in the past to rot and collecting the happy memories. At a business conference last April, I said that you learn much more from your successes than you ever learn from your mistakes. If you remember what went right, it would encourage you, it will give you a sense of self-esteem, and you'll repeat what worked. Whether that's in your marriage, in your relationships, in your career, don't worry what went wrong. Put that in the chicken shed and let it rot. But collect what went right. Remember, you know, when you had a nice time with your partner, when you had a nice time at work, when you got a good contract, what did you do? Remember that. Learn from the successes of life. Forget about the mistakes. Learn from the successes, and you will be a more powerful, successful individual. So when we do look at the past, if we're going to remember anything, remember what went right. It's even better when you're meditating. Don't even remember that as well. Put that away as well. Because now we are resting in the present moment. And don't go off into the future planning what you're going to do next. Gee, I don't know how long I've planned these things, and it never works out. That's why I never plan what I'm going to talk about. And the story was that once I was only a young man. Not a young man, a kid. Going to, I think, primary school. And I had to go to the dentist. I never liked going to dentists. I was afraid of dentists. So when I had an appointment the following day, I didn't sleep well that night. And in the morning, I was begging my mummy, "Mummy, don't send me to the dentist. I don't want to go." She said, "You have to go. Mummy, you don't love me." "I do love you, but you got to go." And I didn't want to go. And I cried and I begged, but I had to go. It was so much suffering. And when I got to the dentist, I found out my appointment was cancelled. All that worry for nothing. This is a problem when we think about the future. We're worrying about things we just don't know about. Which is why it's best, especially in meditation, to train yourself, forget about the future. And as I said last night, and this is a very powerful observation, the best way we can ensure a successful future is by caring about the present moment. This is where the future is born. This is where it's made. This is where it's generated, now. This is the only place you can work for the future. So why keep sacrificing and wasting this moment for something a long time in the future, or even 5 minutes in the future, even 1 minute in the future? If you want to have a successful future, care for the moment. So this first stage of meditation is learning how to be in this moment. No past and no future. In each of these stages of meditation I'm going to teach today, there are three levels. The first level is what we call recognition. You recognize what I mean by the present moment. That space between the past and the future. What's actually happening right now. Not a replay on the TV. Not a sort of a program about what's going to come up tomorrow on the TV. But the live action. That's what we call the present moment. Now once you can recognize that, the next level is called familiarity. And it's a strange thing to say this, but many people in our modern age are so out of touch with the present moment that it takes them a while to get used to what we mean by the present moment, to become familiar with it. By familiarity, I don't know if this is the first time you've come here. This is the first time I've come here. And so I don't know my way around, and I'm not familiar with the place. For those of you who may have come here several times, you get so used to the place, you tend to relax there. Or even when I go traveling, it's usually the case, I understand this now, if I go to a new place to stay, a new person's house, a hotel, or a new monastery, and I go and stay there, the first night I never sleep well. It's just psychology, the body's not used to that new room. But after one day, I get used to it very quickly, and then I can relax. You need that familiarity. Recognize, be familiar with what we mean by the present moment. To have visited the present moment so often, you know exactly what it is, you're familiar with it, to get to the third level, which is you're at ease with this moment. You don't have to try to hold it. Another simile to make this very clear, it's like, you know, you're meeting a new friend. When you meet a new friend, you don't know who they are. Sometimes you don't even recognize them. That's why sometimes, you know, I come here maybe once or twice a year, and people come up to me, do you remember me? Please don't ask me that. Now, I'm a monk, I'm supposed to be honest. And I don't want to upset you. But when you see a person many times, you recognize them. And after recognizing, you become familiar with them. It's like those people are seeing me for the first time. You know, when you first come in here, who is this monk? How's he going to teach? What's it going to be like? When you see me a few times, you not only recognize me, you're familiar with me. You know how I speak, you know how I joke. And when you're familiar, then you relax, you're at ease. Now this is the three levels, and this is goes for every stage of meditation. You recognize what the present moment is. You're so familiar with it, because you've visited there many times, you're at ease. It's like a second home for you. It might be like your favorite restaurant or your favorite coffee shop. You know, they know, it's even the airport in Perth. All those people in customs and immigration know me now. I travel around so much. And they're coming back the last time. Where was it from? That was actually Singapore last week. The guy who stamps your passport, hello Abbott. He calls me Abbott because I'm Abbott the monastery. Where you been? It's very embarrassing. The people in the airport know me more than anywhere else. That's why when people say, what monastery do you live in? I say, I live in aircraft monastery. Anyway, with familiarity, you get at ease. You can relax. It's your favorite restaurant, your favorite place. You know the way around. You're not tensed up anymore. So when you are familiar with the present moment, you soon become at ease there. And that's important because then you can stay in the present moment with no effort. It's just there because you like to be there. Now, already, by the stage of the present moment, you start to feel some great peace. Because a lot of your concerns, your worries, the problems in your life lie in the past or the future. You're freeing yourself from so much difficulty and suffering. And if that's all you ever learn in meditation, you have gone a huge way in lessening suffering in life. Anytime you want, you just go back into that present moment. You might be dying. You know, you might be like some disciples have been in car crashes. Go into the present moment. They stay. They don't worry about what's going to happen next. You know, this old story, one of the fellow monks, his sister wrote him this letter. She was in New York. I think it was in the Bronx. That's where the family came from. And she did what her mother always told her not to do. She went to one of these laundromats late at night to do some washing. Maybe 11, 12 o'clock. The place was vacant. She was in there by herself. And a guy came in, pulled a gun on her and told her to drop her skirt. She's about to be raped. It's a very dangerous part of town. She made a run for it. And two bullets hit her. But before the third hit her, she managed to get into a doorway and bang on the door. And it was very, very fortunate that someone answered that door and let her in and called the ambulance. Later on, they caught that guy. He was a multiple rapist. He would have raped her first and then killed her, because that's what he'd done with others. But they took her to hospital. She survived. And the doctors were quite surprised with two bullets in her body that she survived that trauma. And she wrote back, the reason she survived was because her brother, this monk, had taught her meditation. She'd relaxed. She'd gone into this present moment and forgot about what might happen to her. Putting all her attention into this now saved her life. So this helps you. Once you can do this, when it's really important to be now and stop worrying about the future and put all your energy into where you can do something now, that saves your life sometimes. So we get into this moment, forget about the past, forget about the future, just really in this moment. Not only does it save you a lot of problems and difficulties in life, you know, you're about to have an operation, or you girls about to give birth. Somebody asked me this. So do you ever, that was last night, about the sort of questions, do you even answer questions about ladies, how they give birth? I say, yeah, I do that as well. It's great being a monk, you can teach anything. And how I teach ladies how to give birth, because that's your disciples, they get pregnant, they have to have this birth process. Be in this moment when you're going through this process of giving birth to your child. Because a lot of pain is fear of what's going to happen next. And if you can just get into this moment, just be there with these energies flowing in your body. And you're right here with it. You're not worrying about what's going to happen next, whether you're going to be able to make it or not, whether you're going to be able to endure the next contraction. Stay in this moment. And then you really relax. And the birth process goes quite painless and quite quickly. So yeah, I do teach people even how to give birth. So just with this meditation, present moment, it solves you a lot of problems. And now you're going to go deeper. Go in even further. And the next stage of this meditation is what I call silent awareness of the present moment. This is when you stop thinking. When you stop thinking and pay attention instead to this moment, you will find the mind gets even more peaceful and more still. People keep saying the most difficult thing in meditation is to stop the thinking mind. And there is a great technique. I introduced this last night. How many of you were at my talk last night at the AUA? Please put your hand up. A lot of you, but half of you weren't. So those of you who were at the talk, I'm going to repeat this little exercise so you can recognize what we mean by the silent mind. And even if you were last night, watch it happen again, because as I'm going to be speaking, there are going to be some gaps between my words. I'm going to be speaking in a strange way where I suddenly stop and start speaking again without warning. During the gaps between my words, what was going on in your mind? You're actually silent. Because you never knew when I was going to speak next, you had to wait for me, poised in the moment, listening, mindful, but not thinking anything. That's why I repeat that exercise. So you can see, number one, how easy it is to be silent. You just stop, you wait, you listen, you're receptive. And you don't say anything. That's what we call the silence. It's waiting in the moment. Not rushing into the future to say something or plan something. Not describing something which has just happened, but just being here. Once you could recognize that silence, what we call the space between the thoughts, once you recognize it, you do become familiar with it. One of the biggest problems in meditation is, number one, people don't know what silence is. They don't recognize it. So when the monks say, be silent, what the heck does that mean? What am I supposed to do? It doesn't mean the silence outside. Now, you're always going to have the traffic, or people coughing, or people moving, or the sound of the aircon, or whatever. You can't get rid of the sound outside. I'm saying the sound inside. Now, your sound. Once you can get rid of that, watching the space between your thoughts, then it's such a wonderful place to stay. After familiarity, you'll find the space between the thoughts grows ever longer and longer and longer. The reason is because through familiarity, you're at ease with the silence. The only reason why people find it difficult to stop thinking is because that's all they know how to do, to think. That's what you've been taught at school. Teacher came up and said to you, what do you think of this? And some of you might have said, nothing, miss, and you got punished for being stupid. You could have been a great meditator. But now you have to learn that silence. Not to say things, but to feel things. Not to describe them, but to know them. If you want to know the difference between knowing and describing things, there's a story from the Taoist tradition, Lao Tzu, who was once walking with his disciples through the forest. They had a golden rule. If you went on a walk with this master, you had to keep noble silence. Absolute quiet. You weren't allowed to speak until you got back to the temple. And when you can stand up, come on, be kind. It's quicker. Because people who walk like that, if you keep walking like that, you know that gives the karma, you get reborn as one of those beings that walks like that. But he went up into the mountains with his disciple, and they came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset, and one of the young disciples said, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He'd broken the golden rule, he'd started speaking, and so Lao Tzu turned around, went home, would never allow that man to go on a walk with him ever again. When the other monks said, "Don't be so strict, he's only a young monk, give him a chance, cut him some slack," the teacher said, "No, the reason why I'm strict here is because when that disciple said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. He wasn't watching the sunset. He was watching the words." Be careful there. Because when you're thinking, you're not watching real life anymore. You're watching the commentary on life. And there's a huge difference between experiencing and seeing a sunset and thinking what a beautiful sunset it is. Once you understand that and realize that, you understand it's why only in silence is there any truth and reality. Only when the mind is quiet can you see Dhamma, see the truth. When it thinks, it's not really seeing. It's only knowing the words. So you are recognizing silence, you become familiar with it, and then you're at ease in it. You're not afraid of silence anymore. You know that sometimes people go into forest monasteries, especially the remote ones. I remember this monastery in the middle of Puwur in the far northeast in Nong Khai province 28 years ago. And it was virgin forest at that time. Beautiful waterfalls, tigers and elephants, lovely caves. And in the clearing where this little forest monastery was, it was so quiet that when any visitors came in, they raised their voice. They started speaking more loudly than normal. And it always surprised me, why is it in quiet places people want to raise their voice? It's because many people are afraid of silence. Because they don't know what to do there. They're not used to it. They're not familiar with silence. But with familiarity, you value that silence and it grows on you. You can hang out there longer and longer because you're used to silence. You know what it is? It's wonderful. It's fine. So you leave it alone. You don't disturb the silence. There's an old joke about the four monks who had the vow of silence, sitting in a cave in a monastery somewhere in the middle of Thailand. And they had this vow of silence when one of them sneezed. First monk said, "Bless you." Second monk said, "You've broken your vow of silence." Third monk said, "So have you." Fourth monk said, "I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet." The point is, as soon as you think and make a comment, you destroy the silence. So have that silent mind inside where you notice a space between the words. Let it be. So that's the second stage of the meditation, going into silence. And the third stage of the meditation, where you go into unity of the mind. Instead of having many things to notice in the silence, we choose an object. That's why we usually choose in Buddhism the breath. Now, I don't care if you meditated before or you haven't meditated before. If you've been expert meditators, there's some nuns, monks here, people who've meditated for years, I all want you to do the same exercise. In a few moments, not now, you don't have to change your posture. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and then open your eyes again. Don't need to change your posture. Stay where you are, for goodness sake. It's only 3 breaths, a tiny amount. So you got the instructions. When I say go, not yet. You close your eyes, count three, or breathe in and out three times, and at the end of the third breath, open your eyes. Is that quite clear? Okay, go. Just three breaths. Only three. Some people have still got their eyes closed. Okay. Now, this is especially for those people who have never meditated before. How did you know you breathed in and out three times? Don't have to answer me. Answer yourself. How did you know the breath had gone in once, and then it went out once, and it went in a second time, then out the second time? Went in the third time and out the third time. How did you know that? There must have been some sensation or some knowledge somewhere which told you what the breath was doing. That is precisely what you watch in breath meditation. That which told you a few moments ago you'd breathe in, you breathed out. The reason I teach like this is because sometimes you're taught to watch the breath at the tip of the nose, sometimes at the tummy, and you get it all confused. Keep it natural. How you would normally know you're breathing in, how you would naturally know you're breathing out. And that's all you need to do to watch the breath meditation. Watch the breath in meditation. Just so you know the breath is going in, you know the breath is going out. It gives you something to focus on. The natural breath. When I started meditating, they told me to watch at the tip of the nose. But I suffered from hay fever. So sometimes I watched the tip of the nose and all was coming out was liquid. It wasn't very pleasant. No air. It was all blocked up. So that didn't work. But then later on, as a young monk, we found in the Burmese tradition you could watch your tummy go up and down. I thought, wow, now I can meditate. Trouble was, I was now a monk. And a monk doesn't eat in the afternoon. So in the evening when I was watching my tummy, guess what I was thinking about? It was too close to my stomach. So I kept getting hungry when I started watching down here. And it was a great relief to finally figure out the Buddha never taught nose meditation. He never taught belly meditation. He taught breath meditation. So we watched the breath, not the nose, not the belly, but the breath. In exactly the same way I just taught you. Now that simple teaching has solved a lot of problems in meditators. Shame it's not taught more. Just watch the breath wherever it happens to be. It can move up and down if it wants to. It can go out your ear hole and then in your right toe. I don't care what happens. As long as you know the breath is going in or it's going out. That's all you need to know. That's called the breath. So I did that exercise because I want you to recognize what we mean by watching the breath. That which tells you the breath is going in or it tells you it's going out. If you start watching the breath too quickly, before you've done some present moment awareness and silence, you find you can't hold the breath. You start thinking, it goes all over the place. What many meditators do, they try harder. Come on, you stupid monk, I tell myself. Come on, you can watch the breath. How long have you been meditating? Come on, more effort. The more effort you put in, the worse it gets. You just get tense again. And that's what you're supposed to be doing in meditation. You're supposed to be relaxing. You use wisdom, not force. So instead of doing that, the problem is, too much thinking or you're wondering about in the past or the future, focus on those things first of all. Be in the moment. Be silent enough. And then when the breath comes up, it's easy to follow. It's not hard at all because you've relaxed and softened the mind before you even start to watch the breath. The next thing which happens in meditation is important. This is a crucial part of meditation. It's when your breath, you're just watching the breath go in and go out, starts to become delightful. The breath becomes so lovely. You're just breathing in and breathing out. In order for you to recognize this, the next exercise, again, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes in a few moments, but this time only watch one in-breath and one out-breath. But this time, deliberately, make it the most sensuous, delicious, beautiful, sublime breath you could ever breathe in. Really get into it and breathe out the most delicious, wonderful, soft, ooh, this is so nice, out-breath. See if you can actually make that breath the most beautiful, delightful breath you've ever breathed in your life. Just for one breath. Okay? Close your eyes. Breathe in, sabai. And breathe out, sabai. And after that, one beautiful in-breath and out-breath, open your eyes. Actually, you're all smiling now. Now you can do that. Get an idea of what the beautiful breath is like. It's just, oh, this is so nice. Now you forced, you made that. You faked it. But when you get to this stage of meditation, the breath is naturally like that. This part of meditation, it happens by itself. When you start watching the breath for long periods of time, just going in and out, you get so rested, so peaceful, you start getting happy. What I was saying last night, the happiness through meditation comes from the stillness of the mind. The mind gets its energies back. So don't worry about if you're sleepy. Allow yourself to be sleepy. After a while, that will just pass away, and the mind will wake up, and this breath becomes so beautiful and so wonderful and so lovely. That is the most, I call it the pivot point, the tipping point of meditation. Once you get to this beautiful breath stage, then I don't need to teach you anymore. You don't need to sort of, you know, want to meditate. You have to meditate because you like it. It's good fun. You enjoy it so much. You look forward to meditating. If you don't meditate for one day, it's like, you know, you don't want to, you haven't eaten today. Meditation becomes this incredibly joyful, beautiful thing you love doing. And that's only the start. When you get to that stage of the beautiful breath, you don't need to hold it anymore. It's just there, it holds you. It's like people watch these movies or they watch the soccer. You know, when people are watching the soccer and it's a tight game, you can't get them away from the TV. And then somebody calls and you don't listen to the phone. Your wife says the dinner is ready. You just can't hear them because you're having such a wonderful time. Now imagine that when you're just watching your breath. Just watching the breath go in. And your husband says, you know, someone's calling. And you just can't even hear your husband. Because you're so enjoying yourself inside. You don't want to go anywhere else. That's what we call the beautiful breath. It's in partly the piti sukha comes up with the breath. And once you get into there, then you're away. That happiness gets stronger and stronger, and it empowers your mind. You get deeper mindfulness, you see more, and the meditation becomes so easy from that point on. That's why when I teach meditation retreats, I don't know if maybe a few people here might get into this, they get such a beautiful meditation, it gets to the lunch hour, and we ring the bell for lunch, and a few people, they just don't go to lunch. They just carry on sitting. Ask them afterwards, so why? That was so much fun. I'd rather just carry on meditating than eat. And that's a very big thing for a Thai to say that. They'd rather meditate than to eat. But that's actually what it's like. It's so sanuk, so sabai. You don't want to do anything. Now that's what we call the beautiful breath stage. And it's hard for me to tell you how to recognize that. I did try and breathe in the most beautiful breath and breathe out the most beautiful breath. I did try that. But eventually you get to feel that, you recognize it. And when it happens, you don't get excited. You're just at ease with it. You relax with the beautiful breath. And again, when you get to that stage, you're relaxing with the beautiful breath. Oh, you're away. You'll be a meditator for the rest of your life. Because it's so much fun. It's so great. You get so many benefits from it. all your stress disappears. Because you become happy, you're a much better wife, a much better husband. If you haven't got a wife or a husband yet and you want it, you do become more attractive simply because whoever wants to go out and marry a grumpy girl or an angry man? So actually this is, I not only teach women how to give birth, I teach you how to get a partner and how to keep one. Because then you don't come and complain to me. So because you're peaceful, because you're happy, everything in life looks good. When you're a bright, happy person, you become more bubbly. And why not? It's just the nature of meditation. When you get happiness coming up, oh, whatever happens in life is good fun. That's the power of this meditation. It changes your life. It gives you more energy, more positivity. You see deeper into things, you relax more. And if you want to take it deeper, you can get into some incredibly powerful mind states, which blow your mind, literally. And if you get to the very deep meditations, that's when you've got to come back and see a teacher like me to actually explain exactly what it is. Because sometimes you get some very weird states. If you have someone who's been there before, knows all the tricks of the trade, then it's much better, then you don't get lost. You know that the meditation which it leads to is jhanas. It was in Penang last year, when I was teaching a retreat there. Some of the disciples over there, the Malaysian disciples in Penang, they asked, can you please talk to this woman? She's going crazy. And no one else, the psychiatrist doesn't understand her, the monks don't understand her. And they brought them to me and I gave her 15 minutes and asked her what had gone on. She wasn't crazy. She got into one of these jhana states. And it's very rare. I don't know how she managed to do this. It was so peaceful, so beautiful. It was changing her life. It was only because the people didn't understand what was going on in her mind. And she was so happy afterwards. At last someone had actually understood. She knew she wasn't crazy. She just got into a very powerful state of mind which she didn't understand. And some of the other monks didn't understand either. But it was such a clear case of a jhana. I told exactly what had happened, why it had happened, what to do next. Oh, and she was so happy afterwards. Because sometimes this is important. If you do get into those deep states of meditation, that's when I can really help. And other sort of monks of that tradition can really help. They understand exactly what's going on, what you should do about it. And you feel, wow, I'm not going crazy. This is part of nature. This is what happens. These beautiful lights in the mind, the body disappears, having a wonderful time. Even though it's a wonderful time, and yourself, you know it's good. It feels good. Sometimes, because it's strange, you're a bit worried. Am I going crazy? I'm looking at that wall over there and it's melting like chocolate. Is it supposed to happen that way? Yes, it is. Your perception starts to go strange, but it's great fun. Enjoy it. This is what happens when the mind becomes powerful. Not only you have great fun, you see amazing things. And you've got nothing to be scared of. This is the safest thing. It's a money-back guarantee. I haven't got any money, but nevertheless, I guarantee it. Taught meditation for so many years that it's absolutely safe. You get into any of these states, don't worry about it, just let go and enjoy the ride. That's all you need to do. So that's meditation in a nutshell, but it's also some deep stuff as well.